So I'm happy to answer any questions you have about coming up with this book or other books or really anything. Yes? The castle part, clearly not, because in a way it's based on a sort of archetypal unreal place. The prison actually, to some degree, I did a lot of prison reading, and I had an idea that I might actually do this without visiting a prison. I had spent some time in a women's correctional facility in New Jersey for a story I was working on for the New York Times Magazine about women having children in prison. So it was a female prison. And then, fortunately for her, but unfortunately for me, the inmate I was following was actually released from prison before she had her baby. So my story sort of didn't happen. But it was obviously bittersweet, but basically good. So I thought maybe that would be enough, but I actually found that even with all the book reading I had done, which included, you know, books of prison architecture and all kinds of stuff, I actually felt kind of tentative as I was working on the prison stuff. So I followed various leads and ended up coming up with a fantastic situation, which was that I met via the phone a female corrections officer at a prison in Ohio. And she was on her vacation, but very generously said she would spend a day with me. And it was really a full day. I mean, I got there at like 10 in the morning. I don't think I left till 5 or 6. And I saw everything in the prison. I spoke to lots of prisoners. And that pulled it all together. But I did kind of use the physical plant of that prison, at least in my mind, for this one. So certain things like the line down the corridor and people walking on different sides, and actually the lizard program came from that, but a lot of the other details were things I had already known from my reading, but somehow didn't have the confidence or didn't feel like I had a kind of physical component to all of it until I went to the prison. Oh, and then the Holly's world basically made up, but sort of a vague sense of it being in the Midwest. I'm getting more and more interested in loose ends, which I know can be a little frustrating to readers. So I guess the answer to that is, in a general sense, I am less and less interested in tying everything up in my work. And I can't totally explain that except to say that it feels, somehow it feels the freshest to me or the most real or something. I feel content to have people come into focus and then go out of focus and not necessarily explain everything that happens to them. In terms of the confusion about this book, which you are not alone in feeling, I think it's possibly slightly greater than I had intended. And I can't entirely account for it. I mean, sometimes people are confused about things that are literally answered in the text. So I can't tell whether they were just not paying attention at that moment, so missed something kind of critical, which then, you know, made things confusing to them later on. So I don't know about that, but I will say that in a way it's sort of the stated nature of this book is to ask questions about what we call reality. And specifically, I mean, the part I read doesn't speak to this at all, but the Gothic part, which involves this guy in a castle, looks a lot at modern telecommunications technology and virtual experience, and I try to raise questions about the ghostly nature, if you will, of so much of that disembodied communication. And I found it sort of fun to juxtapose that with the Gothic realm, which always feels very charged with the possibility of the supernatural, and to kind of let us think about the way in which, in a certain sense, we live in a sort of Gothic environment all the time now, where we're sort of waiting for communications to come from outside in some form, but that don't involve a person standing in front of us talking to us. So, and it made me think about the way in which, you know, and actually a lot of the journalism that I've done also led me to ask these questions. You know, first, is virtual experience real, for example? Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I did a piece for the New York Times Magazine about the online lives of closeted gay teens who are out online but totally closeted in their home lives. And it was really interesting to talk to them because they felt that their home lives were not their real lives. They referred to those as like their fake lives. Their online lives, in which they could be open, in which they had friends, lovers, and everything else, whole communities, they referred to those as their real lives. But of course, as we all know, there's plenty of outright deception and also just kind of fantasy and all kinds of other things that go on in that kind of virtual communication. So it's a little tricky to call that real, especially at the expense of, you know, live human interaction that you would have in your town or city. So it just made me wonder whether the word real has stopped functioning, has no longer really describes this gamut of different kinds of experience that we have. And so in a way, if what you call resolution is a clear sense of what is real and what is not, it is the specific goal of this book to muddy that issue. And I did it, you know, I did it gleefully. And so I think it requires a certain like rolling with the punches quality, but it is really not gratuitous on my part. I mean, it absolutely is, it's part of the central philosophical query of the book. And just to talk for another minute about that, you know, in a lot of Gothic fiction, it tends to follow sort of a kind of set form. And if you think of like Henry James's Turn of the Screw, which is one of the finest works of Gothic fiction I've read, you know, an innocent, sort of often slightly helpless or vulnerable person, usually female, arrives at a remote place, and often with a big house or castle, is somehow rather quickly cut off from communication with the outside world, and then begins to experience strange phenomena. And we can't tell whether what she's seeing or he is real, meaning supernatural, these are actually ghosts, or whether he or she is sort of projecting psychological phenomena onto reality. In other words, are they imagining it? And sometimes the question is answered. Like James very intelligently never answers this, and scholarly debate, I'm sure, still rages about whether this woman, you know, murdered a child because she's nuts, or whether she was trying to save this child from horrible ghosts who were lurking around. We don't know. That's what makes it so great. Anne Radcliffe, 18th century Gothicist, does tend to answer the questions and explains them scientifically. So, for example, the horrible tableau of a wormy corpse turns out to be made of wax. And we ultimately hear all of the scientific explanations for all of these supernatural phenomena, which is very disappointing. And works that just rely on ghosts to explain everything don't really interest me either. So as I worked on this, because I have a kind of vulnerable guy, I mean, he may be sort of a, you know, email junkie hipster, but he's somewhat vulnerable, goes to a remote place, and he begins to experience odd phenomena. And he can't figure out whether he's, you know, paranoid, crazy, or actually being hunted. And so the big question for me was, how do I resolve this? Because I don't want to explain it either way. And in fact, the whole point of what I'm trying to do is to make people question the dichotomy of real versus unreal. So that's all to say that it never does answer those questions definitively. And that's the point in this case. I think it might not be earned in other works. And if the confusion is too great, then it doesn't work for the reader. And I'm sorry about that. But that's why I did it. Very long answer, sorry. Sure. Look at Me is a very different book, but actually I think all of mine are pretty different from each other. I finished Look at Me, which was very much an attempt at a social satire. I think it now reads as direct realism, but that's America. And I felt pretty eager. I think, you know, 9/11 occurred the week that Look at Me came out, and I felt like the combination of working for 6 years on a book that was trying to be futuristic and crazy and having things that I imagined continue to happen, which made me realize that you have to write very quickly when you're trying to write satire. That coupled with the feeling of this huge event that I just wasn't ready to try to deal with in a real way, made me very eager, I think, to find a sort of otherworldly setting. Although I didn't think of it that way at all. What actually happened was that I was in France with my husband, who was working there, and we had a new baby. and he had one free day. We rented a car and drove to Belgium, and we visited the ruin of a castle. And I just felt this tremendous excitement being there. And I had, you know, I'd been to ruined castles before, but this was really different. It felt just very thrilling. And I realized that I somehow was going to use, I wanted to write about a castle. That's kind of all I knew. And then I wasn't sure what that meant. Like, did I want to write a novel set in medieval times? That didn't seem like it exactly. And then I realized it was really this kind of archetypal, spooky, and also slightly cheesy gothic environment that interested me. And I was as much informed by James as I was by, Dark Shadows, the cheesy, cult classic soap opera that I used to sneak watching in the afternoon sometimes when I came home from school because my mother didn't approve of it. And the thing is that for me, in a way, the setting is really everything. Like, that's all I start with. I just need to know where. I don't really need to know who. I definitely don't need to know what. And so once I had that, I guess the hesitation was, I mean, in a way, I think that everything that followed was sort of inherent once I had picked that world. But in hammering out the moves of it, I was very interested in writing about, I had come to know of, when I was working on a story years before about fashion models in New York, about promoters, these sort of oddly kind of modern figures who collect beautiful girls around them and then are given money and, you know, free meals and sort of lots of open doors if they bring this entourage of beautiful girls with them. And I thought, like, what a strange job. I mean, how could we have reached the point where that is a job? And I was kind of fascinated by who these guys were. And sometimes they were foreigners, so this was kind of their way into, you know, the kind of hot center of American life they felt. But sometimes they were like middle class kids who had chosen this as their thing in life. And I really wanted to find someone, I wanted to write about someone like that, someone who had, in my opinion, you know, mistaken access for achievement, you know, proximity for real success. I just thought that seemed fascinating. And in the end, it was interesting to me how totally that tied in with the question of real versus unreal. You know, Danny is this guy who feels like he has everything in moments because he kind of knows everyone. He can sort of get to anyone, but he has no actual power and he hasn't actually achieved anything. So he also kind of has nothing. And I found that binary interesting in light of, you know, it's the now kind of cliched question about, sort of internet communication. I mean, do you have a million friends if you spend all day talking to them, or are you alone? Well, kind of both. Once I sort of knew all of that, I was just in a very different realm from Look at Me. It was actually hard to shake Look at Me in terms of the voice, and that was actually a real problem at the beginning because the voice of Look at Me is very urban and ironic and sort of knowing, and I found it totally ill-equipped for this material, and it often sounded that it was sort of mocking the Gothic realm. It seemed that that speaker would scorn writing about a castle or caring about it, that it would seem really dumb. So I really struggled with that. And then it was when I realized that my speaker was a character in the story, and it came to me that he was the prisoner. I had sort of known there would be a prison, but I thought it would be near the castle. And when it was, I suddenly realized that this was a sort of a text inside a text, which is very Gothic also. Then I felt like I was finally free of Look at Me, and I was kind of on my own. The voice, I find, is really everything. So that was the transition. Now I'm trying to shake the keep. Oh, and what I'm working on now, I've been working on stories that are related to each other, and I think I'm enjoying that because it allows me to leave so many loose ends. I mean, even more, because there's no way I can tie all this together. So I actually do think that's why I'm enjoying it. And then I'm researching a new novel that is kind of it's a historical novel, so it's really requiring a lot of research before I start. Yes? I have a thing about swimming pools. I don't really know why. I dream about them a lot. I remember pools that I've encountered since a really early age. It's a total mystery to me. I mean, there was a circular swimming pool that I used to go to when I was a little girl with my dad. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously it's a potent symbol, without even a clear sense of what it symbolizes. But I think that's a case where, I mean, I don't write from my own life much at all. I'm quite bad at it, actually. But that's a case where the deep significance of it for me seems to be personal, but I don't even quite know what it is. But somehow I knew there would be a round pool in this environment right from the beginning. That was one of the first things I knew. And I sort of remember encounters with like murky overgrown pools as being very charged and kind of frightening. Like the thought of diving into one of those pools is sort of horrifying and exciting at the same time. And a lot of cheesy like horror movies seem to have those pools. But actually there's one other thing. I saw an exhibit of Bill Viola's in, I think it was like, it was quite a while ago now, sometime in the mid 90s, and he had this piece, I can't remember what it was called, although I have looked it up since, that involved a kind of time-lapse filming of a rather overgrown looking green pool, rectangular pool. And it looked like there were these ghostly figures, but it was more just because of the way he had videotaped people approaching the pool and moving away from it. And that piece was actually really in my mind as I thought about the hallucinations that Danny has and what they were like exactly. And again, it sort of gets at that question of real versus unreal. There was someone there. It is a videotape, and yet it's a chimera. It's not a real person. And so that was actually, I thought about that piece a lot, and I think that was in my mind too. I don't like to say too much, but I would say New York, you know, World War II and right after, and especially the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I'm really interested in the women who built ships. And I actually have gotten slightly, possibly too deeply into my research there, because I've gone so far as to partner with the Brooklyn Navy Yard Development Corporation to work on an oral history interviewing the surviving women who worked there. And I was, in fact, at a board meeting this morning there, and they were basically saying, why can't you go faster? And I felt like, oh my God, what do you want from me? I'm one person trying to do all these things. But I've done a number of these interviews, and transcribing them is very painstaking. And I'm doing it to help create this record, but also very selfishly, just to have access to these women and their stories. But I do need to move into a different phase with that, so we'll see what happens. You know, it's always a tricky thing when you're intertwining a couple of worlds to figure out what to read to what audience. I often read the first chapter of the book, which combines both, but frankly, I'm a little bored of it. And I feel like when I get bored of it, I can't explain why this is, because the words are on the page, but I feel like it just doesn't work as well when I start to feel that way. And I hadn't read this part in a long time, and I felt kind of excited about reading it, so I thought that would be a good idea. And also, I do think it's kind of fun to read about a workshop to students, because I haven't actually taught in a prison. I thought about doing it, but I was worried because of the problem of not liking to write about myself or being very good at it, that I might actually make it harder for myself to write about teaching in a prison if I had personal experience of it. So I interviewed a lot of people who had done it. But I just from the stories of the people that I interviewed, it was perfectly clear to me that in some sense, a workshop is a workshop, you know? I mean, you know, you don't generally find people knifing each other over poor comments in a workshop, but I bet you if you could read people's minds, you would find that it's only a matter of, you know, impulse control. So that was also why. Yes?
What exactly?
I don't know if I can ever answer about anything I do what exactly I was trying to achieve. I mean, I feel like a shopping list consists of a bunch of things I exactly want to achieve, but I think writing a book is something much more, it's a little bit more of a question than an answer. I guess the way I think about the Baroness, who actually is based on a real person, believe it or not, unusual for me, but I did work when I first came to New York for a woman named the Countess of Romanones. And she was a really colorful, larger than life kind of figure who had been a spy for America during World War II. She had worked for the OSS. And she was very beautiful. She had been a model with Hattie Carnegie before that. And she ended up marrying a Spanish count and living in Spain as a very grand countess. She was incredibly imperious, very difficult, incredibly hot-tempered. But she began writing about her experiences as a spy and publishing them as nonfiction, although what she actually called it was faction, because, in fact, there was a lot that was made up. But she was actually a big bestseller in the 80s and 90s. And so I was her private secretary for 2 years. And I would often think, I somehow have to use this woman. I mean, she's just too much. And so it seemed clear to me that I was thinking about this castle, and I knew that I wanted there to be some descendant from the original family of the castle there. And I was thinking of a count. And then I first of all thought, there are so many men in this book, why am I thinking of another man? And then as soon as I had decided to make it female, I knew that I would basically be using the countess, but in a slightly exaggerated form, although not that much. But I guess the way I see Danny's encounter with the Baroness is the point at which he sort of crosses over into a state where he truly cannot figure out what is going on anymore. Up until then, he's essentially been in control. And at that point, he loses control, and he really never quite regains it. And so I saw her as a sort of a crossing over for him. She lives in the keep, which is the central part of the castle. So I guess that was really how I saw her functioning. Yes? You're paying tribute to the cleverness of Random House, which created a website to beguile readers of The Keep, which looks somewhat convincing because you're certainly not the first person to be fooled by it, as if the hotel that is posited here actually exists. But in fact, it's all made up, and I wrote some of that copy. And the pool is actually is in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. So it's all made up. It's just for fun. Any other questions? Last chance. Yes.
Is The Keep really being made into a movie?
Who knows? I mean, I sold an option, and there's been a script promised ever since January, which never comes. So. I don't know. I mean, what are the chances? I think the chances are tiny. And even tinier that it would be watchable if it does happen. But as long as they pay me. No, I don't know. I think it's a long shot. That's my gut response. Just seems like a weird one, yeah.
Have you been on Oprah and do you have a relationship with her?
No, have you?
No. I know Stedman, though, but
no.
In the book, it says you're part of the O Club, right?
Oprah has a magazine, which does a lot of book reviews.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Yes. Sure. I'm always curious about that day-to-day writing process. You know, it depends whether I'm writing a first draft or whether I'm into the editing mode, because. For me, I mean, I write by hand, first of all. I write fiction by hand, always. I'm actually unable to write fiction on a word processor. Can't quite figure out why, but at this point, I'm tired of wondering, and I just follow this. But so I tend to write my first drafts with very little plan. I mean, it's really blind, and I think actually that is why I like to write by hand. I have terrible handwriting. I cannot really see what I'm writing as I write it. And in some cases, I never can actually fully decipher it. But I write very quickly and in a sort of automatic way, I would almost say, so that I really don't know what is going to happen until it is occurring in the moment of writing it. There's something about the physical act of writing that seems to make it all. That's where I get my material. So that happens quickly. So for The Keep, I maybe spent 5 months writing the first draft. Then what I do is I take the first draft and I read it, and I try to figure, well, I have to type it first, of course, and then I try to figure out what I've got here, what it's trying to be, and what, in a very careful way, I make an outline of what I need to do to try to get it there, move it to the next level. In the case of The Keep, the first draft was so atrocious that I had gone on a little retreat and left my son and husband at home and planned to spend 2 days, you know, just meditating and planning. I was so appalled that I turned around and came straight home from Rhinebeck or Rhinecliff. I'm not sure wherever I was, it was not the one where I wanted to be, which was the first sign of trouble. And I came home. But then I come up with a very careful outline. In the case of Look at Me, the first outline I did was 80 pages long, single-spaced, in 10-point type. I mean an outline. Because I know that once I go back into the editing mode, I sort of again become kind of, I'm not thinking analytically anymore, so I need clear instructions of what needs to happen. And so then I begin executing the outline. When I'm in that editing mode, when I'm in the writing of original material, I can only do for a limited amount of time. So I would say I usually try to write 5 pages a day, like legal, on a legal pad. And it can take as long as 3 hours or as little as one. Once I'm editing, I can do it almost around the clock. I can do it on an escalator, in an elevator, anywhere. And so in a way, my writing schedule changes depending on what point I'm at. And so if I'm writing original material, I can often do other things during the day, like journalism or things like that. And if I'm editing, it really envelops me. And I can work all the time. My best hours are definitely morning. Nights were never great, and now with little kids, they're just impossible. So that's basically, I like to sit in a, I don't like sitting at a desk. I like being kind of slouching in a big comfy chair, and with all I need is a pad of paper and a pen. Or a draft, you know, a printed draft that I mark up and then type in the changes each time. That's the way it works, or doesn't work. All right, well, thank you very much.